You're listening to Pirate Cat Radio, KPCR LP 92.9 FM Los Gatos, and KMRT LP 101.9 FM Santa Cruz. Tony Duchesne here, and welcome to Drinks with Tony. This week on the show, we have Cara Black. Stay tuned. She's on in 43 seconds. First, I just want to tell you, the Screenplay Holiday Workshop. We are closing registration on Friday. So to join, go to drinkswithtony.com. Limited to 6 students. We're doing a 2-week workshop over the holiday break. That's right. If you're an orphan just like me and you just want to sit down and grind out some work, then register for the Screenplay Holiday Workshop. It's a 2-week workshop. Drinkswithtony.com has the link. And now on with the show.
Hi, I'm Cara Black, and you're listening to Drinks with Tony. Get on the Drinks with Tony show.
Yeah. You're listening to Drinks with Tony. I'm your host, Tony Duchesne. Today on the show, we have Cara Black. She's the author of Huguette. Cara, how are you?
I'm good. I'm raising a glass. Can you see that?
Oh, look at you raising a glass. I'm raising my sparkling protein coconut water with yuzu.
Very LA, Tony. Very LA. Totally. This is espresso. So.
Ah, the espresso. Listeners, you'll know why we're talking about Paris so much in a little bit. But when I was in Paris and when I was throughout Europe, I felt like I ended up drinking less caffeine than when I was there than when I came back to the States. Is that like, am I out of my mind, or is it like, do they just not infuse it as much as like in the States?
I don't know, Tony. I drink it in Paris too, you know, but there's so many new little cafes, coffee, you know, barista, very like signature coffees, and which is different from the regular, you know, cafe with the terrace. So
yeah,
I don't know. Those are pretty heavy duty, you know, the
okay.
small kind of hipster bar, cafe bars. So
okay.
I don't know, you know.
I'm not going to the hip places because I mean, if anyone wants to know anything about Paris, you just say hi, Cara. And she is the queen of everything Paris. Because how many Amy LeDuc novels? Oh, hold on. I think I know the answer to this. This is like I'm Alex Trebek or to myself right now. 22?
21.
Oh,
21. You were close.
But are you writing one?
Yes.
Okay. I was referring to that one too. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Okay. Yeah.
No, that's so much fun. There's going to be another one, remind me if I'm wrong. The last book was during World War II. Is that correct? That was
3 hours three. In Paris. Yeah.
And now with Huguette, it's after the war.
Right. Right. Very different time. Yeah.
Yeah. What? Because these are your two novels that are not of the Amy LeDuc series. Is that correct?
Or well, do you have one more? Well, I wrote another one. One more, Kate Reese, who was in 3 Hours to Paris, the female mm-hmm. sniper, she comes back in Night Flight to Paris in
right,
1942.
Right. Okay. So we have
so that one. Yeah.
So yeah. So it seems like there's something that really intrigues you now about World War II and Paris.
Yeah. There's so many stories, you know,
yeah.
And I'm sure you hear them too. But, you know, I read a lot about it. My family served. And I don't know, I was just always in the background, you know, small things, you know, and a comment here or there. And my dad was always watching. Do you remember Victory at Sea?
No, I don't. What is
No,
that?
you're too young. But, you know, all these old war documentaries at night, mm-hmm. late at night, and on summer vacations, I would stay up and watch them. And you know, growing up, there was this kind of current of people my dad's generation, my uncle's generation, who, you know, had been there. So
yeah.
Maybe I absorbed it. But I was really fascinated by the time after the war, you know, post-war France, after the liberation. And there just, you know, wasn't much written about it. And it was really significant, you know, and because rationing, you know, just we all think probably. Or imagine those pictures of the GIs on the Champs-Élysées. They're in their jeeps, they're handing out champagne, chocolates, the girls, they're kissing the girls. Well, you know, that's a moment of euphoria. But that was a very narrow window because life continued with rationing for many years in France. The winter right after liberation was the coldest winter on record. There was no coal, there was no heat, because the Germans, the 4 years of occupation, had stripped the country. And so the farmers, all their machinery, and just think of hoes and tractors, they were scrapped for metal, for ammunition. And France was very much rural, you know, a rural economy, agricultural economy then. And in August 44, when we think of liberation and the GIs, right then, the war was still going on in the Pacific. And this is August 44. We still have December coming up, 44, with the huge Battle of the Bulge, you know. And then they hadn't crossed the Rhine until 45, the Allies. So the war didn't end. And then until Hitler committed suicide in April 45, the war ca had kept going. So there were, you know, of course, there was a reverberation in the rest of Europe because people were struggling, you know. People were returning from the prisoner of war camps. Men were meeting children they didn't even know. People were coming out of the camps. How would you deal with people who'd been, you know, lucky to survive a concentration camp? Plus, the women who had stayed home or were at home working, trying to put food on the table for 4 years. Now they're dealing with a man coming back. And, you know, it was just, there was a lot going on. So.
When you're working on these books, do you feel like that you almost place yourself back in those years when you're that deep into it?
I tried to, and I was just in Paris, and when we missed each other,
Missed
literally.
each other by that much. I think you were like, we can meet tomorrow, and I'm like, oh my God, it's my last day. I'm about to die.
Well, it was funny because I was staying with my friends then who live in this really cool loft, but their heater had gone out. No hot water, no heat. And so I was staying there, and you know, and then I was freezing. I couldn't take a bath or a shower. I went to my other friend who lives in the Marais, and he goes, "You want to take a shower?" I said, "Yeah, after 4 days after getting off a plane, sure." And he goes, "Hey, I have this other place. You could stay there, and you know, maybe someone will come. But do you want to stay there, get warm, and clean up?" And so I got to stay in this other apartment. But I sort of felt inside, "Oh my God, am I living through what you get did? I'm such a lightweight, only 4 days, you know."
Did you
But
bring
yeah,
it
I
on?
mean.
Did you bring it on yourself? Because you wrote about that, and then the universe was, as we write, we kind of, channel all the stories of everything, right? And then the universe is like, and let me let you feel that just for one split second.
Oh yeah, it was really something. I thought, oh, what a lightweight. But yeah, I mean, you think about it, you know, a lot of places, I mean, never, you know, the bathrooms were down the hall. There was you would go to the public baths for a shower or, you know, to clean up. So, you know, life was different, but without heat, you know, and with everything rationed. My friend's mother, I went to the farmer's market. You know, you see them all over Paris one day, and we were looking at vegetables. And I saw I think it's a rutabaga, really ugly root vegetable. It's kind of, and at the time, that was this big thing with this nouvelle cuisine. All these young chefs were like, "We're making the topinambour, and we're making a foam, you know, this foam and all this, you know." And I said, "Oh, let's get one of those and try that." And she goes, "Never, never. That's all I ate during the war." And I was like, okay, you know, very different.
Not only would she be sick of it, but just that the taste probably brings back the other sensations of memory.
Yeah, exactly. So there's things like that that you go, yeah, and I can bring myself in a matter of speaking back then. And for me, it was like, so you get when we start off is 17 years old. And I thought, if I was 17, when I was 17, how would I make my way? How would I face these choices and try to make decisions and be orphaned, pregnant, on the run, black marketeers searching for her, hunting her, trying to, learning to reinvent herself just to survive. And so yeah, I and assuming different identities when she could. I really like to play around with that. I don't know if you find that, but assuming another identity, because we all have personas. When we meet a friend somewhere, when we go and we're in a business situation or formal, or we all have different kind of personas in a way. And so I thought, well, what if that was constant?
So it's so fun as I continue to just get older, and all not only in writing but just like in life, where you talk it's I really think we I don't know if the personas so I know so much changing too much, but I think we just adapt to who we're talking to. Like I adapt to my friend a different way than I adapt to a student, than I adapt to, and they also approach me in a different way. It's almost like we've learned the social game, and we play the social game, and if we disrupt the social game, it would confuse everyone. I remember taking improv classes at Bay Area Theater Sports in San Francisco, and that was my first time that I learned about status games. They called them status, and we use it in writing all the time because we're playing with power dynamics and we're shifting power dynamics, and that makes it interesting when our characters go through that, and especially in film or TV when we do it in a scene. When you shift status, it's fun, and people, that's like it grabs people quicker. And our instructor told us to shift status when we were like at going get to get coffee or something. Just use the status play of what we learned, how to play high status or low status, and watch the person immediately shift to the other side. And it's weird. It happens. And they're like, do not do this with your friends. You don't do that with your friends. You do it with strangers. If you want to play like and just kind of see in the real life world, do it with people you don't know, because we all have our own status that we present kind of in the hierarchy in general, and that just truly fascinates me. It's yeah, I'm always I think about it way too much.
No, I think that's great. And in the book, you get, gets involved with the film studio and is watching the actors and actresses. I mean, she has a very small job in the canteen and later rises up with the director. But she said, but what one of the actresses tells her is that it's all about perception. We put on costumes, we do makeup differently, we have wigs, we have different body movements, and that's so that the viewer will have a different perception of us. It's shifting their perception. And so I and that sort of talks to what you were saying, the perception and how you are, and physically you can do that too.
I was just talking. Somebody was complaining about a celebrity that I know through her daughter, and I kind of know way too much about this person. And then she was just like, she, oh, "What is it? She was she's like, she didn't say she was insane. It was more just like she's just not on this earth." And I'm like, "Oh, I know." I'm like, but that's what makes her a great actress. They call it the empty vessel. Like she's like, there's nothing going on, but put a good screenplay in front of her, and she will act that better than anyone that I know that is not an empty vessel. Yeah, they have to inhabit so many different characters that it's almost like they do have to empty themselves. And There's a sadness to see it, but at the same time, their passion is acting. And they probably look at us writers and go, it's sad to see that, but their passion is writing, you know? So it's like, what's it like being back in touch with Amy LeDuc? Because does she get mad at you now that you put her off a little bit? Is the when she when you come to her, is she a little kind of like uele cara, je ne sais pas.
Well, she's immediately confronted with the big problem, and I think she sort of brushes
Oh,
any irritation. She
oh,
has
I love
right
that.
away. Yeah, on the first page, she's got other problems. So she's probably, okay, let's move on. Okay.
She doesn't even have a second for you. She's like, "What? Okay, I got work to do. Yeah, you're here, whatever." Just
Right. And I get to, in the new one, I get to have dual timelines. So there's a timeline with Aimée, and then there's a timeline with Claude Leduc, her grandfather, who founded the agency, who we meet in Huguette. We see him, right? We see him opening, being a rookie homicide cop in Paris, and then founding the detective agency. So he's going to return. People like him. And I said, of course. He's a bon vivant. He likes to cook. He goes to the, he's a bargain hunter at the auction houses. He's got a good eye. And voila. He's sort of like my French grandfather. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Now it's who was your were your parents French too, or like how so your well, the grandpa's from France.
No, Amy's grandfather. I just said in my
Okay.
just
Got
in
it.
my mind at the keyboard. No, we are mongrel Americans. We are just American. We're from whatever stock from the Midwest, born in Chicago. I have no French background, but I did go to a French Catholic school when, for elementary school. So I think those French nuns got their hooks in me somehow, and it's like, when we had French nuns who spoke French, a long time ago. So, there was always that kind of, and during the summer, so we would, learn current French. They got us all subscriptions to the magazine Elle magazine. Before it was, in English or, on Instagram or anything, I would get, these weekly Elle magazines, and I was like, oh, it was all about France and all in French. And I know these arcane facts about all these movie stars, about how many wives Alain Delon had and what his dog's name was when he was with Romy Schneider and all this, things that no one, people go, how do you know that? A French person will go, it was just, well, I guess from the Elle magazine.
The same magazines that they were reading or their parents were reading at the time.
Right,
Oh,
right,
that's
right.
so fascinating. So that makes sense that that France and Paris would have its hooks in you then.
Yeah, they sure do.
I know you really are you when you were young, you were like really traveling, like even through like North African desert and stuff. I vaguely remember about us talking before COVID about how you were on like motorcycles in the Sahara. Was it is did I get that right? My memory is working? Oh my God.
Pretty close, yeah. Northern route, Tunisia, Algeria, and Morocco, near the Mediterranean, but on the kind of the desert was over a little bit further, but yeah.
Oh, cool.
But yeah, basically it was fantastic. I can't believe it. During Ramadan, when people don't eat during the day, and we had no idea what was going on. We were like, where's the cafe? Why can't we, nothing was for sale. And we were like, oh, it's Ramadan. You can only eat at night. We
So
ride these bikes. Yeah.
did you find immediately, like at night, did you like buy as much stuff as you could for the next day too, so you can get through?
We tried to, and people were eating and everything was full, and we were trying to buy stuff, and we were sleeping in the fields or in a farmer's barn, and it was, You do that when you're young,
I know. Yeah. Now I'm just like, just yeah, at least clean sheets, please. I wish I could do the youth hostel thing, but it's just like, I just, yeah, guys, old man here just needs his space. All right. So can we have a geriatric hostel instead of also youth hostels where it's just like, we're all a little cranky. We want to talk to each other, but just give us our space after a time. That might be a business idea right there. Geriatric hostel.
There you go.
Yeah.
There you go, Tony.
Well, there you go. That's problem solved. I think we did it just now. December 12th, 3:24 p.m. on a Friday. Even though this is going out on next week. Yeah, that's so cool. So, like through your because I know you've traveled everywhere. So, what was it about Paris in particular that keeps you grounded in Paris? What was it about Paris? Because it could have been somewhere else. You could have been doing these. Even if you stayed in France, there are many other regions that you could have really explored just as much as you have explored Paris. So, what was it about Paris that pulled you in?
Well, I when I got there finally, it was more than I thought. And then I thought, there's so many stories here, and there's so much, history, right? You can't get away from it, not that you want
Yeah.
to, but there's just so much here, and I just then when I went back after that, I stayed with my friend. And she took me to the Marais. This is before, it is not like it is now, gentrified and hip and Instagrammable and all that. It was very run down. Buildings were sagging, soot stained.
Yeah.
And she took me to this building and pointed to a window and up in the upstairs and said, "That's where my mother lived during the German occupation of Paris."
Wow.
She was 14. She wore a yellow star. She came home from school one day and her family were gone. And in 1942, right, they didn't
Yeah.
really know what was going on.
Exactly. There isn't no oh, by the way, here's the playbook. Yeah.
And so she ended up living in the apartment. Somehow the concierge shared her rations with her and going to school thinking, oh, they're going to come back or,
Yeah.
they never did. And later she found out that the Hotel Lutetia over by the Bon Marché, the very fancy, fancy hotel now.
No.
Very, you got to go there for a drink, Tony.
Okay, that's on my
Sorry.
list.
The bar at Lutetia. Well, now it's
Well,
all
but well,
fancy.
but well, but before I head back there in April, you're getting a whole you're getting a whole worksheet from me. It's going to be your homework of where I need to hang before I hang out with you, or when I hang out with you, whenever, because we're actually crossing paths as long as I don't get out of Paris too soon to go south.
Right. I think we should have a drink at the Lutetia.
Okay, yeah, that's it.
Yeah.
That's okay.
And I mean, it'll blow the budget, but once, it's okay, right? Just glass
Exactement, exactement.
of
Because the rest of the time, I am low budget. I'm
Me too.
yeah.
Me too. So anyway, then it was run down. The Germans had used it for the military intelligence. And then de Gaulle took it over, and it's where all the people coming from the trains, from the camps, would come to try and, with the big Red Cross meeting point to find relatives, and that's where people went. And one day a woman said, "I saw your sister get off the train at Auschwitz." That's all she ever heard. That was it. So
Wow.
I never forgot that, and I thought, well, I have. Who would know this?
Yeah.
And my dad, who was a big mystery reader, said, "You always talk about that. You should write it down. You should explore that." And I was like, "How would I approach it? How could I, all this?" And then he handed me a book. It was by P.D. James, An Unsuitable Job for a Woman, about a young woman who becomes a private detective through certain circumstances.
Yeah.
Thinks on her feet, and I was like, yes, I loved it. And I realized The detective novel, crime novel, crime fiction, historical fiction, these are frameworks to hang a story. I mean, you know that you teach writing. It's a way in. What's the way in? You know, through crime and investigation, and so once I found that, I was like, yes, this is my way in. You know, this is how we can find out. This is how we can, have a plot point twist, and it's, so that was it. That started my life of crime. So,
Wait, were you into the crime novels before you started the Amy LeDuc series, or did you start to embrace them as you were coming up with the with when you were coming up with the early elements of who she was?
yeah, I had only really read Nancy Drew when I was young,
Mm-hmm.
which I loved. But it was my dad who really said, read this one. Here's
Yeah.
some by Georges Simenon, the Inspector Maigret novels. And I really started getting into it,
Yeah.
and there weren't a lot of foreign translations at the time. This was before, I think it was Stieg Larsson, The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. Remember that?
Yeah.
I mean, that kind of burst open that, oh, we wanted to read Nordic crime or international crime. And there really wasn't much, it's like that before. So that's when I was finishing my manuscript, and the field was very narrow, but some people were more open to that. So that helped me. But yeah, that's when I really got into it.
You know, well, I'm reading, this is more of the con artist story, but I'm reading The Grifters right now by Jim Thompson. I can't even remember if I got the author right. I know he's huge and there's a ton of people going, "How could you not know that, Tony?" But I'm starting to get more into these types of like con men or crime fiction than I ever have before, and I don't know why it took me so long in my life to really go there. And I really want to start writing that type of work, and I don't even know where I'm going to start yet. Because I've ventured to too many other places, and I'm like, maybe I need to ground myself in one of these types of because just listening to you being able to explore Amy LeDuc for so many novels, I mean, that's really getting to know a character like beyond belief. And there's got to be, and she's probably still showing herself to you every new book you work on, yeah?
Yeah, I was just figuring out her new nail polish color. I'm like, well, what did she wear before? And she knows she has to go and get a manicure, and what would it be? And what do I have now? Metadata mauve? No, megabyte something mauve. Before it was gigabyte green, now it's something mauve. I don't know.
Are these real
But
nail polish colors?
yeah, she. They're
Oh.
always cheap, but she's just noticing as she's doing something that her,
Yeah.
but it's like a cool color. Yeah, and now she has her daughter is now 5 years old. So I, had to, getting pregnant, having a child,
Right.
not being with the biological father, dealing with the problems they had, and trying to be, a good mother and run a business. And that's been very difficult for her, but
Yeah.
it's like a lot of young women in Paris,
Yeah.
single parents, maybe they have a relationship. A lot of people don't get married these days. Did you notice that?
I kind of noticed it. I was, I was married for a long time and I've been divorced a long time, and I'm just kind of noticing that people like almost, it kind of hurts my soul, but like people think of marriage almost as a bad thing, and I'm like, they assume that I'm against it because I went through kind of an ugly divorce, but it was for various reasons, and part of it was like religious stuff. So but at the same time, I still feel very positive about marriage, and I would get married again. And people like young, especially younger people, are just like, "You would what?" I'm like, I enjoy being a husband and having a wife. That was fun. There's yeah, it sometimes it ends very poorly, but It's also, I think it's also worth the risk, and it's a cool ride. It's, you know.
So the biological father, who was a good father when he was around and,
Yeah.
doing it on his terms, but sadly he's killed in the last book, so
Oh, did you enjoy killing him?
it was his time, Tony. It
Yeah.
was his time.
Yeah. No, everyone has a time, and you're the god of the story, so you're just like death. You're like page 263, death.
Well, actually, he's killed right away in the last book, Murder Life, right away. So,
Oh, wow. Okay. Yeah.
we know that, and yeah, but it is hard for her because she knows that Chloe loved her father as she
Yeah.
remembers him, and so it's always tough, no matter what. So she's dealing with that and running the business, and Huguette, of course, has a different issue with the child that she. That she has, because she was raped and has to deal with that because Huguette, who was of her time, was a very religious Catholic, went to a Catholic school, was
Oh.
religious, has to deal with all of that in her mind. And she, was from a small family. And so all these decisions and things she has to decide, life-changing things, really for a 17-year-old is a lot. I
And then
think.
throw a post-war World War II at it, and it's, yeah, it's unfathomable. That's the thing I like about going into Paris, and even the couple times I went in the 1990s, it's that you feel just there's something just different in the energy because of the closeness of how much destruction and how much like atrocity just happened there, and yet life goes on. And I don't think for those of us who've lived in the United States and never had to experience it right on our front door, or had our parents or grandparents experience right at their front door, never do we fully understand it. And I think that it's well, plus I love walking amongst the spirits of the dead writers, because so many of my favorite writers are French. So the minute the plane lands, all of a sudden I feel like there's a comfort, because I'm just like, well, hello, Victor Hugo. Hello, Baudelaire. Hi, everybody. Let's walk amongst the streets you walked.
I often, well, not often, I have sometimes gone to where Henry Miller would hang out in Place de Clichy,
Oh,
the
really?
Weppler. Yeah,
Yeah.
and
Where did he hang out?
at the Cafe Weppler,
Okay.
Weppler, right at Place de Clichy.
Yeah.
And he would, have coffee there, hang out with the prostitutes who
Uh-huh.
probably bought him coffee or whatever. And now they have good seafood. I mean, you can have oysters. But so I often think, oh, this is where Henry Miller was nursing a coffee all day or whatever.
Right. Well, the one that, like, especially the Tropic of Cancer era, when he was just always hungry and b begging for hoping that he would get a meal from a friend over dinner. You know, I did like I had this plan, and the plan fell through, but that's okay. Sometimes we need to make plans and have them fall through. I reread Tropic of Cancer last year, I think, and as I the fir first time since the 1990s when I first read it, and it kind of still held up, and it touched me in a different way. When I was younger, I was just like, he dirty, you know, and it's I was like, wow. But at the same time, Henry Miller is a great writer, and I'm just like, wow, just why does this affect me? I read it now, and I read it as more of a story of grief. It kind of blew my mind. It was just like it was almost like he was grieving and acting out at the same time. But what I did, what was insane, and I still have all my notes, everywhere that is mentioned in that book, I have every single address. And there's about at least 80 to 100 of them, because he's talking about everywhere he walks, he's telling you exactly where he is. And I wanted to go take photos of every single place. Like, that is one of my projects I want to do. Hopefully I can do it next year. just the photo that's mentioned where like the place where he stayed, which I think is in the second. I can't remember the Villa Borghese, he refers to it, but yeah, plastic cliche. When I was there earlier this year, I stayed in the 17th, and I walked down to the Cemetery
What?
Montmartre. Yeah, and
Yeah,
I've
yeah.
never been there before. I've only been to Père Lachaise, and oh my
Oh.
God, that cemetery is so cool. I like what a it, and it wasn't crowded, and it was as sexy as Père Lachaise in certain ways. And I got to sit there with Dumas, because I had read The Count of Monte Cristo for the first time a few years ago, and I'm just like, I gotta hang out with you, buddy. That was good stuff. You did all right, man.
Yeah, I know. And the road goes over it, right? You don't, you're going like, oh,
That's
there's a
so.
cemetery under here.
Yeah, no, I walked across it, and I took photos of the graves from the top through the fence. But it's so strange when you enter the graveyard and there's a road right on top of you, and tombs that are like barely touching the top. They're just, and I'm like, that's so Parisian. Well, we can't move the cemetery, but we need a road. Let's compromise.
I
Daddy,
like
why does Grandpa have cars driving over him?
know.
Yeah. So with Amy Leduc, what neighborhood are you exploring with this novel?
We're because I've done all the arrondissements and I've done one twice by mistake, 21 books. So,
Oh, no way.
yes, I did. I goofed. This one is not arrondissement centric.
Okay.
So non-arrondissement centric, we go all over Paris. And we also have a timeline in 1968 in Paris and at the May 1968, riots at the Sorbonne. So that's the other timeline. So we go left bank, right bank, all over
Yeah.
to the office, but kind of all over. But oh, also just for Huguette, I got to go to Lyon. I got to get out of Paris and go to Lyon, 2 hours south of Paris, when the Lyonnais call it, the gastronomic capital of
Yeah.
France. And
Yeah.
well, the
Have you
Parisian.
been before, or was that your first time?
I went briefly, and then this time I went and spent some time there, and I loved it. I love Lyon, not only the food, but it's like the portal to the south of France. The light is different. The roofs are terracotta tiles, kind of like the south. They have these long traboules, which are courtyards. They go from one street to the next street, but there's like four of them because they're so deep. And then there's people living in each one, and they're very Italian, like Renaissance style. So you have this mixture, it feels different. It's more relaxed than Paris, it's not as frenetic and but I like Lyon a lot. I really recommend it, 2 hours from Paris.
I've been looking at all the other cities of France, and just very, because I'm going to be in Toulouse a little bit. Have you been to Toulouse? You see, I've never really, well, I went out in the 90s. I hung out in Nice for a while, and that was gorgeous. And there was a little town called Biot, I think it was called, and that's where we spent most of our time, which was about tw 10. It was kind of like near Ez. It was up in there a little bit, and it was a cooler spot to be, where it was just more local instead of the tourist on Nice. And but that's the only other area that I've really explored, and I want to.
Toulouse is the red brick city, I think. Yeah, and Antoine de Saint-Exupéry, who wrote The Little Prince, he was an aviator. And he was there's we stayed in a hotel where he used to stay, like the pilots, because I think they flew to North Africa for the mail drop or something, or the mail.
Oh, interesting.
And I guess he started writing The Little Prince there, or whatever, or something. And he took off one day, stayed in the hotel, took off one day, and never came back. Right, we lost him over the Mediterranean. And there's Toulouse is very interesting. They have the huge aerospace industry and down there, and yet very nice. university.
And literary, a friend of mine, his book was just published in French, and they put him on a French tour, and he was all over like Toulouse, Pau, like all these little spots had like these he there was a ton of stuff for him to do in that little area where it was just like he was like Paris, Bordeaux, boom, and then most of his time was right in that little stretch.
Nice, very
Yeah,
nice.
I was just like, oh, I got this. I'm having lunch with him on Tuesday, I think. So I'm gonna ping him with questions. He's probably
Yeah.
listening to the show because he's a friend and he's right there. He probably just rolled his eyes and went, "Oh man, okay." And I'll get the text. Hey Tony, dude, I can't make it. Can we do another time? The problems with talking about real life, it's does it. I like to think of the worst things that can ever happen jokingly, but sometimes does it really actually happen? Do I say things where people go, you know what? I need to cancel my appointment with Tony. I can't believe he said that 2 weeks ago.
Oh, never canceled an appointment with you,
I
so
know. Yeah, that's I've kept notice. I'm like, I think Kara is okay with me. Wait.
the other day I passed by. I'm on Cesar Chavez Street. Remember once you used to record down in that old building? I passed by there the other day and I thought, oh, I thought of Tony.
Oh, did I have you in that studio too?
It was
Wow,
very cool. Like 1920s, or it had been a stable or an ironmonger or something.
And we had the front little corner. That was our little spot. Yeah,
That was
oh,
nice.
I really miss that era. Like, I feel like that era of San Francisco with pirate radio that we had going, and just kind of what was bubbling. Just I don't want to be that guy that's like, well, back in my day, but I don't know. There was something that we kind of I feel like we lost a lot when I went and visited San Francisco again after moving to LA, and this is before COVID, when they tore down that whole block that had the Hemlock and the other bar right up the street, and I just walked by it and it was bulldozed, and I'm like, wow, that's the end of an era. Like hanging out at the Hemlock, and what was the bar up the street? It was a transvestite bar with a punk band room upstairs, and I can't remember the name of it now. Oh man. Just gone, just completely wiped off the face of the earth. There it goes. Retail condos. But you've stuck it out in San Francisco.
Yeah, I love it here. I
I do
do.
too, yeah.
Yeah, and I can just take my roller bag, go down the hill on 24th Street to BART, and take BART to the airport, no car involved, and hop a plane
Yeah.
to Paris.
Isn't that
I love
great?
that.
Is Cafe La Boheme still across the street on that BART from BART on 24th and Mission? It's on 24th.
If it is, I haven't seen it recently, but I
Oh,
haven't
okay.
been looking. Wait, yes.
Yeah. It's the
Yes.
old cafe. I used to write there all the time. That was just I used to write there. This would be 20 years ago. Say that out loud. I used to write there, and they had it was like you got a cup of coffee, you got the bagel with lox and all the works. And it was $5 with free refills of coffee.
Well,
And
that's a
it's
long
just,
time ago, Tony.
well, not only that, that was very cheap for the time too. So they were like, I don't know. And I think maybe people didn't venture there so much because there were times when I was like looking across the street and going, oh, wow, that pimp is beating up a prostitute. Well, okay then. It's, it wasn't a, it was still a shaky, there was shaky moments there. So, but yeah. But I love that place. I was Bohem. What are the cafes in San Francisco that I totally adore? I was talking to someone else the other day. It was Bohem. Oh, Max Fields over on I don't know if that's still there on 17th and Dolores.
17th and Dolores. I don't know.
It's like yeah
At
that.
eight, there at 18th and Dolores, I don't think it's called Maxwell's. No,
Max
but
Fields. Oh, okay.
I usually go the 18th. I don't really go 17th, so I don't know. It might still be there.
And we have
Yeah.
a lot of new ones too, you know. So
There are new ones now, yeah, that are they good?
some of them are really good, you know, and you know, they're very hipster. You know, people are in there with their laptops, and it's
Can
you
people
know,
talk to each other like they used to? Can we go back to that somehow?
would be nice. Would
Do
be nice.
you feel like Paris has kept that culture?
More so than many other cities.
Yeah.
You know, I remember riding the metro in Paris, and people were always reading a book, you know, a small paper
Yes.
book or
Yeah.
whatever. And then now it's the phones, but which is everywhere. But I still sometimes see people reading books, you know, and I always like that. I feel that's great, you know.
Yeah.
You're in front of the phone all the time, and then your phone can get stolen in the metro. So why not just read a book? You know,
Oh, exactly. And I walk up to people who are reading books. And I'm like, hey, what are you reading? I try not to be too confrontational. Hey, what are you reading? But it's such a rarity that I want to talk to this person. And it's also led to beautiful conversations. And it's also the reason why I read The Count of Monte Cristo, because I met some young dude who was reading it, and he goes, "You," and I was like, "Is it good?" He's like, "Oh no, you haven't read this yet. You have to read it." And I'm like,
very exciting.
well, if this young kid's telling me to read it, then I have to go get it. And if I hate it after 50 pages, I can blame him, or whatever. And then I couldn't get enough of it. I was just like, he was right. And I've been trying to, this was in my neighborhood. He must have moved or something. I've been kind of, his name was Buddy. I've been like kind of looking for him ever since, got to thank him. But I just love those interactions, because back when I worked in San Francisco in the 90s, like taking any train or taking any public transit, you had a book on you, or you had the newspaper, you had the Chronicle. And I remember working at the Bank of America building on California and Kearny, I think. And there would always just be people like kind of just sitting there on the steps reading during their breaks. It was, but I don't think people understand the pre phone era of what you did. You read and you talked. Sometimes you smoked. It's just
I
like,
noticed that on airplanes too. Used to talk to your seatmate, you know.
yeah.
And now people are, I just got back from Houston and it's like no one talks. You're all watching a, you know, something on your
Yeah.
phone, whatever. You know, I mean, I confess I listen to a book, but I, you know, and sometimes I think I'm gonna bring a book, a little paperback, because you know, what if I run out of battery, which often
Right.
happens, you know, and here's something I don't have to charge or whatever.
Yeah.
And I can just, and I do see, I saw some people reading on the plane
Yeah.
a book, and you know, then others are just watching that. But I miss talking with people on the plane. And it used to be you were like, oh, I hope I don't get next to a big talker who just yap, yap, yap the whole flight. But now I think I'd like to have that
Right,
problem,
exactly.
you
And
know, in
well, and there's
a
also a bonding too that happens when, but in those days, because I remember flights, you're talking about your destination if you're both going. I remember the first time I went to Paris, which just scared me to death, to be on a plane and be on that long flight. I was talking with the guy, and it was his first time in Paris, and we were just chatting here and there along the way. And then he's all, well, he's like, as we're getting out through customs, he's like, I got my ride, I gotta run. And I'm like, and I was in my head going, you got a ride like into Paris? And I'm like, I gotta figure this out from here. And the RER didn't go all the way to Charles de Gaulle yet. And I'm just like, oh, your ride? Really? Okay, your ride. There he goes, he's off to Paris. I'm just like, okay, now I gotta figure out the autobus to take me to the RER, to take me to the So much fun.
I
What? So,
recommend,
go ahead.
landing at Orly, you know, the other
Oh my God.
airport.
I flew into Orly for the first time from Portugal. Yeah. Orly is like amazing, because I think it was like the 14 line on the
Line
metro.
14, you just get on that and go right into Paris.
It was, I was going, I want to fly in here and out of here all the time.
That's
Yeah.
what I do. Yeah.
Do you fly,
Perfect.
you'd go from
San
San
Francisco,
Francisco to Orly. Wow.
yeah, direct. Hey, that from LA too, and
You get right on the 14 and you go right into Paris. So close
It's
to my
not.
friend's house. I'm like, yes. So
Yeah,
good.
that is so cool. Oh, you are also doing Amy LeDuc tours in Paris in April. What's the info on that? Like, is that mainly for people who are there already, or are people flying in to also do the tour specially?
Well, basically, it's my friend organized it because I can't organize anything. And each day
You can
we
only organize huge, gigantic novels that take years to write. Yeah, that's nothing but the
well, like practical things, you know, anyway.
Yeah.
So we have a group. We're sold out for April, but we're thinking maybe we'd do it again in October. But we go to places in my story.
That's
So
so
on the
cool.
we stay in the same hotel. Every night we have apéro, you know, wine and snacks. Talk about the day or talk about the book or have a. Last time we had demonstrations on skying your scarf like a Parisian. And then my friend who runs the police crime lab came and talked about her work. So I can, you know, try and pull some cops in to talk or medical, you know, forensic pathologists. So every day we go to a different place. And the first place in April we're going to go is Boulogne-Billancourt outside Paris on the outskirts, 45 minutes from center of Paris, two places in the book Huguette. So we're going to go to the
Cool.
studio, to places where she was, to the old Chateau Rothschild. And yeah, and the next day we'll go to different, then we'll do some Amy books or
Oh, that
three
is
authors in
so
Paris.
cool. I wish every author would do that with where they set their books.
It's really fun, you know.
Tony Duchesne here, and we interrupt this program for a very special message. If you want to hear the rest of that interview, go to drinkswithtony.com. But right now, we're talking about something very serious. So sit down and listen, children. You're listening to KPCR, and we are independent. We are community-powered radio. What does that mean? That means we don't have any corporate overlord giants looking down at us, trying to screw with our programming. We program what we want. We are volunteers at this station. We just love this station. We do it for the love, and we love you, the listener. And we need you, the listener, to donate to KPCR. Go to kpcr.org/join to donate. And we really appreciate it. I will. I'm gonna sit back and tell you a little story about Pirate Cat Radio. I started Pirate Cat Radio with the show Drinks with Tony probably 20 years ago, maybe more than that. This is how far back it goes. We were in San Francisco broadcasting, and we had so many studios that we were in. We even rented there was like a closet space at a theater called the Dark Room in the Mission District. And I would sit in that little closet space, and we kind of had to be quiet because there was theater going on at the wall behind us had events. It could either be stand-up comedy or a play. And so we had our studio all set up, and it was so much fun. And it was probably, I would say like 6 feet by 3 feet, so that would be 9 feet squared. And I even had bands come in, and we would all be smushed up against each other as we interviewed. I also did the book, the author interviews in those days. So the first hour would be an author, and then the second hour would be a band. And I would tape the author usually at their event in San Francisco, because in order to get them in person, they had to be coming through San Francisco. This was the olden days. We're so much more tied to online now. But that was the glory days, and that's where I started at Pirate Cat Radio. And what's great is Pirate Cat Radio restarted up after the San Francisco days, and I've been able to be a part of it now. And I've been doing Drinks with Tony, and then all of a sudden, worlds collided, synced up, and our station manager, our founder, said, "Hey, do you want to do the show on Pirate Cat Radio again?" And I'm like, "Are you kidding?" in a hot second. Let's go. And that's how it went. So I'm glad you're listening. And I just wanted to let you know that Pirate Cat Radio means a lot to me. It means a lot to a lot of people in San Francisco. From us old timers who have been around it and been around the block. After the dark room, where were we at? I think we were at we had a studio in the Bayview District. And oh, so many memories there. I was just telling a friend of mine when we were on Pirate Cat Radio in the Bayview District. I had this band, the Belmar Dolls, come in. And the show after me, for some reason, I was on Saturday nights at 6 o'clock. So I went 6 to 8. And then the show after me, the slot after me, for some reason, was open just for a little while. So 8 to 10, I would put it on what we called Robo DJ. But Belmar Dolls were in the studio, and they were having so much fun, and we were drinking so much beer, and they decided that they were gonna they wanted to stick around the studio. We're in the middle of nowhere in the Bayview District in San Francisco. They wanted to stick around the studio, and they wanted to keep just playing records. They were like pulling CDs off the shelf, and the drummer of the band was like, he had a big list of how they wanted them listed, and we were just dancing around and jumping off the couch and just jumping all over the place. And we went till 10 o'clock, and it was a beautiful sloppy mess. After that, we finally put Robo DJ on at 10 o'clock, and then we went from Pirate Cat Radio Studio in the Bayview District over to Emmy's Spaghetti Shack, which used to be on a different location in San Francisco. And we continued to get even more hammered. It was a very, very... This was back when Drinks with Tony was actually drinks. People make fun of me now, as you'll hear on some of these interviews, that they're like, oh, we don't have any drinks. And I'm like, you have no idea how bad, how drinks make bad radio. I want it to be vulnerable. I want it to be, kind of scary when we talk and just feel the feels, man. Because but it's fun to look back and go, wow, we were so crazy kids in those days. The drummer was so tossed from the Belmar Dolls that when we were sitting there and Emmy Spaghetti Shack has spaghetti, his face fell into the plate of spaghetti. And the lead singer, I think his name was Peter. Peter had to pull his face out of the spaghetti and wipe him down. That's how a lot of Drinks with Tony's nights on Saturday nights went. Now we're at a proper time on Pirate Cat Radio. At 4 p.m. on the afternoon, a proper time where you're driving and you just got off work and you're doing your duty as a human to continue to work with the collective. And as we all work with the collective, Pirate Cat Radio is a collective. We're volunteers here, and we just do it because we love it. And we would like you to be part of our collective. To join us, and by joining us, you can donate some money if you enjoy our programming. If you're listening now, I'm assuming you enjoy, because you didn't change the dial. So go to kpcr.org/join. Also, we're open for volunteers. If you want to come to the studio in Los Gatos, or even if you want to help us out, go to the contact page on kpcr.org. And feel free to just see what you can do with us. We're a little crazy, just to warn you. We're not fully adjusted to society. And if you're not fully adjusted to society, that's probably why you're listening right now. And that's probably why we could really use your help. But at the big help we need right now is some cash. So if you can donate a little cash to us, go to kpcr.org/join. Hey, thanks for listening to Drinks with Tony and all the radio shows that broadcast here on Pirate Cat Radio. And I hope you have a great day, a great week, and I'll see you next week. You're listening to Pirate Cat Radio, KPCR LP 92.9 FM Los Gatos, and KMRT LP 101.9 FM Santa Cruz.